You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Thank you for coming to our program on Emerging China-Russia Access, the Return of Geopolitics, This is the third in a series of programs on Japanese and American views on key areas of the world outside of East Asia. Obviously, the United States and Japan have to be well aligned on issues and situations within that region, but the out-of-area places matter too. I'd like to welcome those people who are participating by webcast, as well as the people who are here. I'd particularly like to thank the panelists, two of whom have come all the way from Japan, and I just made the long trip across the Pacific, so I feel their pain. One of our Japanese panelists is Akihiro Iwashita, who is a professor in the Slavic Eurasian Research Center at Hokkaido University, and at the Center for Asia-Pacific Future Studies at Kyushu University. Aki-san was also a visiting fellow here in my program in 2007-2008. Aki, it's really nice to see you. Our other Japanese panelist is Professor Chisako Masuo, who is an associate professor at the Graduate School of Social and Cultural Studies at Kyushu University. She received her PhD from Todai in 2008. Coming all the way from the fifth floor of this building is Tom Wright, who is a fellow and director of the Project on International Order and Strategy. He is also a fellow in the Center on the United States and Europe. Coming from across town is David Gordon, who's a senior advisor at Eurasia Group, and he was formerly the firm's chairman. He's based in Washington, D.C., and before joining Eurasia Group, Dave spent more than a decade in the State Department, the National Intelligence Council, and CIA. Before that, he and I were staff members on the House Foreign Affairs Committee. This was at a time when politics in the Congress and work in the Congress was actually fun, and before our political system went badly awry. Our departure didn't cause this, but, you know, I'm sure it's as sad for Dave to watch it as it is for me. Now, the important part of the title, the most important part of the title of this program is the punctuation mark at the end, the question mark. We do not want to prejudge the question about a return to geopolitics, but have a serious discussion of what's going on. Of course, Russia and China have reasons to cooperate based on shared interest. Some of these may be disturbing to the United States or Japan, such as Russia's arms sales to China, but that cooperation doesn't necessarily rise to the level of an axis, quote-unquote. The second most part of the title is the word geopolitics, which incorporates the idea that in international relations, physical geography actually matters. And it matters in the alignments of actors in the international system. In 1949, Mao Zedong, the chairman of the Chinese Communist Party, declared that China would lean to one side. That is, it would ally with the Soviet Union. And the fact that China and the USSR shared a long and common border, it was not the only reason that the Sino-Soviet alliance became a security problem for the West, but it was one important reason. In the late 1960s, as Sino-Soviet relations deteriorated, that same fact of a common border became a boon to the West and Japan, and made more complicated Sino-Soviet relations. Again, it wasn't the only reason, but it was a reason. So the question today is whether the economic and foreign policy convergence of China and now Russia, the two countries that dominate the East Asia, the Eurasian landmass, pose particular problems for policymakers here in Washington, in Tokyo, and other capitals in East Asia. Part of this question is how deep and enduring this alignment is going to be. But that is a question for our panelists. And so the first person to speak will be my colleague and friend Tom Wright. Each speaker will come to the podium, and then we will all sort of migrate to the chairs. So, Tom, would you like to start off?
Thank you, Richard, for that kind introduction, and thank you all for coming here early this morning to Brookings. There's nothing like a discussion, I think, on China, Russia, to get everyone to channel their inner Henry Kissinger to think about geopolitics, and it's a great pleasure to be here with Richard, with my good friend David Gordon, and with our Japanese colleagues as well. Welcome to Washington, and I very much look forward to our discussion. There's a story that Hank Paulson tells in his memoirs, and many of you may be familiar with, in the fall of 2008, when the international financial system is collapsing, and he goes over to China. He's at a dinner, and his Chinese counterpart tells him that the Russians have approached China with a rather interesting proposal, which is to collaborate together to try to worsen the economic collapse in America by dumping Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac in large volumes to really put pressure on the U.S. Financial system, and that this is the way, once and for all, China and Russia can sort of deal a blow to the American hegemon. And, of course, the Chinese response is to immediately reject it out of hand and inform the U.S. Treasury Secretary and to declare sort of solidarity with the U.S. In trying to save the global economy. It's a story the Russians vehemently deny as ever having happened, but Paulson is adamant that it did, and I think it sort of gives us a baseline in terms of 2008 that, you know, that is certainly geopolitics was not present, you know, on that day. And certainly China and the United States had sort of a common sort of outlook on the international financial system. And even, you know, months later, when President Obama took office, there was a reset with Russia. There was something of an easing of tension. So if there is a return to geopolitics, it is quite recent. You know, it's not something that's been there for a decade or more. There are always, there are always issues between major powers, and they never fundamentally see eye to eye. And so I think our standard has to be, you know, does it pass that threshold of normal sort of economic competition and normal disagreements between states and actually get to something more fundamental that, you know, other countries may want each other to be fundamentally weakened or for the balance of power to fundamentally shift. And so that, I think, it's what we need to ask. And my answer is actually that I think we are seeing that. And what I want to try to do in sort of 10 minutes or so is just like take a little bit of a step back at the beginning and just say why I think we came to this point, what Chinese and Russian strategy actually is and why it is geopolitically competitive with the U.S. and then maybe just how to think about the relationship. There are, I think, significant differences between China and Russia, and I know David will get into some of those, but I want to sort of take a look at some of the areas of commonality to start out. I think that the fundamental sort of driving philosophy behind U.S. strategy in the 90s and the 2000s was a sense that we were all on the same road, like we were all going toward the same type of international order, and that the United States, China, Russia, and others had a shared interest in the global economy, and that they had a shared interest in the institutions and the infrastructure of international cooperation, and crucially that the challenges they faced in common were much more important than what divided them. I mean, you see this continuously, beginning with Clinton in his later sort of years of his presidency, but especially George W. Bush, who says, you know, that the era of great power politics is over, and we now face a single great common threat of terrorism, and this is something that all the countries of the world have to come in to fighting, you know, together. Obama takes that, also talks about terrorism, but climate and other transnational challenges, and the philosophy essentially is that we're all in this thing together. These small differences that may have occurred in the past are very minor, very peripheral. Everyone should see this sort of common danger in much the same way that European countries cooperated against revolution in the early 19th century, sort of a new sort of concert of power, which is not to say they always agreed, but it is to say that there was a large measure of acquiescence in sort of U.S. leadership. You know, when even when the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003, Russia didn't respond by sending troops to Iraq. You know, it didn't respond by arming Saddam Hussein. It responded by registering its objections at the U.N. Security Council. If you look at what's happening today in Syria, I mean, there's a very dramatic difference in the type of response. I think what that sort of view got wrong was that it believed that this international order wasn't particularly threatening to Russia or to China. And I think actually, if we're completely frank, it is actually somewhat threatening to both of them, but not in the way that's regularly sort of thought of. It's not because NATO troops are closer to Russia. You know, I mean, that's a bit of a red herring. And the fact of the matter is that European forces have diminished significantly over the last 20 years, and Russia faces a lot less of a threat than it used to. I mean, there's no, you know, objective reality in which the threat, the conventional threat to Russia has increased over the last 10, 15 years. And it's not even really this sort of U.S. force presence in the Asia Pacific. I think it's two things in particular. The first is that the U.S. view was that these countries over time would become democratic. And, you know, that was expressed through diplomatic means, but more importantly, through a sort of robust regional order. I mean, the European Union strengthened, expanded, brought in other countries, and it culminated, obviously, in the partnership agreement with Ukraine, which was creating potentially a healthy democracy right on Russia's border, which had the, you know, the precedent of maybe a color revolution for Russia sometime down the road. I think Putin understood that that sort of strong sort of Western regional institution was a threat to his regime, not because anyone was trying to topple his regime, but simply because it created what he regarded as sort of a hostile environment. China's situation is a little bit different, but I think there was a lot of, and still is, some concern and even alarm at certain, you know, at sort of, you know, democracy and at some of the long-term sort of trends. And so the first one, I think, was that the world was not necessarily safe for authoritarians. And the second was that these countries wanted, as they got more, as they recovered, as they became more powerful, they wanted what they almost have always had, which is a spheres of influence order. They wanted some greater say in their region. And they weren't able to do very much about it because the power balance was so out of whack in the 90s and 2000s. But now they had the option. And as sort of the environment changed with the financial crisis and other things, and as they became more authoritarian themselves, I think that became a more attractive option. So before I get into sort of just the Russia and Chinese strategies for how to do this, I do want to say a word about why this matters. Because I think, you know, we think of the international order often as a pyramid or something where, you know, the global is this incredibly important thing, right? And then there are these regional issues. And what's really important is what the Chinese view of the IMF is, or the World Bank, or whether or not Russia wants a replacement for the UN. But I think that actually the international order really rests on healthy regional orders. I mean, it's much more important that Europe is at peace than it is that there's agreement at the IMF, right? It's much more important that there's no sort of conflict in Asia than it is that China is sort of a, you know, has a greater say at the IMF, or, you know, that there's new members admitted to the Security Council. I mean, the basis of a healthy global order are these regional orders, which stands to reason because, you know, territorial integrity, the lack of conflict, I mean, these are the basic building blocks of a peaceful sort of international order. And the region is also where countries get most dissatisfied with most quickly, right? They don't sort of start out by wanting to replace a global institution. They start out by worrying about some dispute they have with a neighbor. So to me, when we see this sort of emerging sort of spheres of influence, you know, agenda, it is pretty significant because it has long-term implications for pretty much everything else. I do think it's important to note that the Russian and Chinese ways of going about this are pretty different. And we make a big mistake, I think, if we say, you know, Russia and China are both revisionist or both dissatisfied and sort of lump them together. And it actually also sort of creates a bit of a straw man for people to say, well, actually, they're quite different, than to explain that and then to say, you know, you're completely overreacting about the geopolitical side. So I think, you know, Russia is a power that is in a long-term decline. It is a power that is a, you know, is a doesn't have very much going for it outside of sort of military side. It doesn't build a lot of things. It doesn't make a lot of things. But actually, when it looks at its environment, you know, it sees Europe, the European Union, as a soft power, superpower that poses a threat, but it sees it as a hard power weakling. I mean, it believes that it has a hard power sort of asymmetrical advantage because, you know, it is increasing its military capability. And if you think about military power, not as overall percentage of GDP, but what power you can actually deploy realistically in a crisis, then the balance of power looks quite different, you know, in Europe. It looks a little bit more favorable to Russia. And when you combine that with the will or with the determination to take great risk, then it evens up sort of even further. And so they, I think, see two sort of fundamental objectives. One is to weaken the European Union and weaken the European security order with a view to fundamentally remaking it at some point, to try to sort of change this sort of NATO, US-dominated, Western European-dominated European security order for something else. And Medvedev and Putin and all others have talked about that at some length. And the second thing is to use hard power on a sort of an opportunity basis to try to remake their near abroad or to make themselves sort of relevant. And China, I think, is almost the opposite. China is a rising power with a lot going for it. It has a lot of economic power. It has a lot of means at its disposal other than the military. But I think the point that isn't sort of fully understood about Chinese strategy is its objective, because we often hear, well, you know, they want to kick the United States out of Asia, or they want to take over Asia. That, I think, is not accurate. But what I think is accurate is that they want power parity with the United States and Asia. They want to share East Asia with the United States. And they want a large measure of control over the western part of the Western Pacific, sort of a sphere of influence within the First Island Chain, control of the South China Sea. And it wants to accomplish this in sort of a unique way, because Chinese strategy, as I see it, actually is predicated on there not being a conflict. I mean, Chinese strategy only works if there's an absence of war, right? If you think about these islands they're building in the South China Sea, in any sort of conflict, all those islands go away very quickly, right? Because they're liabilities, they're strategic liabilities. But if there's no conflict, they create a new sort of environment in which they do have power projection capability. And so their strategy is to gradually, beneath the threshold of conflict, take incremental steps that gradually remake the regional order to their advantage. And they need to sort of ensure that there is no sort of conflict, there is no war. So it's actually quite stable, I think, in the terms we normally think about it as peace. But the question is, does it sort of become unrecognizable over time, where it puts immense pressure on sort of that U.S. system and weakens the alliances because China's influence is rising? And that raises a whole series of questions of how to respond, which I won't sort of get into at the moment. But I will just say that that the Russian and Chinese visions, I think, are sort of regionally based, and they are trying to increase their influence. They're very different. One is quite aggressive. One is not aggressive in the traditional sense of it. Both, I think, are revisionist in terms of their long-term objectives. And I think they have one other shared sort of objective, which is that they worry about the US-led global system being able to put sort of pressure on them. They don't like the idea that, you know, Washington and Berlin and Brussels can decide to kick Russia out of the international financial system if they disagree with the invasion and annexation of Crimea. They don't like the SWIFT payment system whereby, you know, that there's Westerns, you know, the West can decide just arbitrarily to kick them out or not let them participate. And so I think they have an interest in trying to protect themselves against that, in trying to delegitimize to some degree that sort of power, particularly that sort of financial power as a deterrent, to try to create some sort of a safety net where they believe it's sort of safer for them to operate. And so that's how I see this cooperation. It's sort of a German-Soviet pact or something where, you know, there's going to be mutual endorsement of each other's geopolitical aims. It's more that they have a shared interest in hedging against this US-led global order because they want to be able to achieve their regional objectives. I think that we ought to be careful about trying to split them apart too quickly because, and I'll finish on this point, because when you go to Europe and you talk about European security, you often hear European countries say, you know, we have so much on our plate with Russia, we just really need to work more with China to get some economic growth, and, you know, what's going on over these uninhabited rocks aren't that important, and we have to work sort of together with the Chinese. And then when you go to Japan, occasionally you hear, you know, we have our hands full with China and what's going on in the Donbass and Crimea, like we can't let that sort of interfere in the great power game in East Asia. But the truth is that, especially from here in Washington, is that both these things are incredibly important, right? And you can't sacrifice one for the other. And that what you have to do is to respect the fact that there always will be differences with European countries and China, and there always will be differences with Japan and Russia for very particular reasons. And there will be scope for a little bit more cooperation between each of them and China and or Russia. But we need to keep in mind that this is part of a overall challenge, right? It's part of an overall challenge about how to preserve sort of a rules-based liberal international order against an alternative, which is sort of a more spheres of influence-based order that wouldn't work to anyone's advantage. And there are certain commonalities there, the rule of law being one, territorial integrity, respect for borders, and there ought to be more solidarity between the regions on these key matters. And so I would just urge everyone to keep that in mind as we talk about sort of ways to, you know, have sort of more cooperation between Europe and China or Japan and Russia, or, you know, the risks of having Russia and China push closer together, that we do need to sort of adhere to these basic principles of what makes the liberal international order actually sort of worth, you know, having. And a respect for law, I think, is a key part of that. So I will leave it there and look forward to this, to the discussion. Thank you.
So good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'd be very happy back at Brookings 7 years ago when I worked here in geopolitics, borderlands studies between China and Russia. But few people pay attention to Sino-Russian relations. Why today so 100 people came? I'm amazed to hear. That's the first thing. Second thing, I was in 2007, early 2008 visiting fellow. When I listened to the speech made by Daniel Freed, the assistant, then assistant secretary of state at Georgetown University, he did not mention the name of China, but he suggested we had the revisionist country in Asia Pacific. He said that. And he said Russia, not revisionist country. So the potential partner with the Japan, United States, Asian Pacific. So what changed now is probably in most of the people's frustrated with that Russian revisionist works. So therefore today I truly are invited to say something to the new ideas. So my presentation consists of four parts. First, geopolitical shift in the quadrangle US, Japan, China, Russia. Second, how China-Russian relations have changed. Third is very important. Is the China-Russia alliance emerging? I today pretend to be provocative. I think that China-Russian relations are reaching the initial stage for making the kind of alliance. Finally, how US-Japan reacted. So, guys, in Washington, pay attention to Central Washington. So as my experience is, experts on Russia think the Russia as extension of Europe through Atlantic. In expert on China, look through the Pacific next Japan. So as far as I know, these schools are separated and rarely overlapped. Of course, some good researchers are, but not so many 7 years ago. But for Japan's geopolitical scene, the US-Japan-Pacific alliance, but we neighbors China and Russia. Therefore, we easily think Russia-China relations much more than in Washington, D.C., through the Eurasian conflict and cooperation. So if you look at the continental Eurasia next to Japan, so a couple of decades ago, main conflictual zone in the middle tier, the inland border conflict. But recently, we recognize sea area, maritime area is very critical. So we should think reconsidering the 19th century type geopolitical. For example, maritime power, inland power, continental power versus sea power. I think it's old fashioned. Now, the current situation, continental power is sea power's rivalry and cooperation. This is a truth of nowadays, I think. Then, Russia, look at the Arctic. China, as you know, the senior purple area is disputable. And it's a shocking map 5-6 years ago, Robert Kaplan's the China's expansion. And India is also an interesting position. So my thesis is that the current situation, inland conflictual zone shifted up to northern tiers and down to southern tiers. Particularly southern tier is critical now. Then we back to this map where Japan. Japan is a front of conflictual zone. We shared, overlapped some disputed sea zone with Russia and China. So in this sense, Japan is now crisis for new geopolitical shift. Then, they conclude first part. The asymmetry points, U.S., Atlantic Central Perception, Russia-China. Japan, Pacific Central Perception, Russia-China, and particularly shared with narrow seas of Ohotsk, Japan, East China with neighbors. China-Russia sharing 4,000 kilometers inland borders, 7,000 in Soviet era, but transformation, relatively peaceful on inland borderlands, relatively conflictual on the maritime borderlands. Then Japan as a regional pivot for Sino-Russian relations. So if you think of the geopolitical situation, Russia and China, they have so huge borderlands, that they are surrounded by many countries. So it's a kind of border paranoia. We should think of this phenomena. Then in Eurasian continental, China and Russia are so big. So it's not only a bilateral impact on the border conflict if it happened. And the surrounding countries also influenced by Russian China. So China-Russia, if back to the history, so it's a critical, even in the Qing Dynasty, Russian Empire, Manchukuo, Soviet Union, PRC, Soviet, and even post-Cold War. it's a centuries confliction. So I was a border traveler in China, Russia, since early 1990s up to the mid of 2000, almost 25 watchers of these borderlands. So of course it's you know well, it's Damansky Island, Qianbao Tou in China. Now this was a kind of symbol for Soviet PRC's border disputes. The paying attention early 90s, what happened? This is a mess. Collapse Soviet Union and also the China's advancement on reform and openness. So there's so many signs of phobia in Russian flights, China migration. Then they remembered the bad image on Damansky conflict, Qianbao conflicts in 1969. So probably you forgot. In the middle of 90s, some rumors, Russia, China war would happen. People were very paranoid, particularly Siberian and Far East. But up to the end of 90s, migration issues now, of course, workable, but calm down and controlled, then tranquilized. This goes on China threat. Even now, China threat perception is, but completely down in comparison with 2 decades ago. And solution, demarcation. So thanks to Shanghai process, it's a border disturbance, full alert, and mutual concession on dispute borderline, 50-50 formula. Then 2000s, Good Neighbor Friendship Cooperation Treaty. No more claims and some couple of institutional arrangement between two. Then particularly, I pay much attention the surprise of October 2004, the Haitians and Borisov Ussuriski, the 50-50 solution, because owing to this Haitians island, Russia and China went to the war at the end of the 1960s. So map 6, the junk point Ussuri and Amur rivers, this is a Haitians now, Borisov Ussuriski in Russia, 300 kilometer squares. Finally, they dealt cut half and half almost. Then it's kind of a symbol of a cooperation, China and Russia. So this kind of the symbol on the island now. It's interesting landscape. Over there in the middle, it's an Orthodox church Russia kept. In the left side, it's China, the border tower. What is the like? This is a park. China built a park far eastern. China loves to watch the borderlands as sightseers. This is a kind of a peaceful relations. Russia keeps, of course, it's a church, but this line, the half and half cut. This is, here's the China soil over the Russian soil. This is open for tourists, and they built the facilities. So, 5 minutes remains. I conclude second, third points. So we think of the new geopolitics. China and Russia, they call themselves now the comprehensive strategic partnership. I don't know what it is, but comprehensiveness have some nuances. First, number one, free from past geopolitical border, bad burdens. Second, psychological personal improvement. It's a very amazing. If you quote a couple of the opinion, 2009, 60% Russians thought China as a strategic partner. But 2014, 85% Russians thought China as a strategic partner. Rivalry. 24% Russians thought China as a rival, 2009. 2014, just 8% they thought. So enemy concept, just 1% of Russian mass perception. It's amazing change in 5 years. So we do not underestimate this. And this is also different stages. Early 90s, early 2000, China-Russia shared the concept of non-interference from outside. But now they share some a kind of common values, non-democracy regime. I'll back later. And they are few competitive interests to key areas. Russia, United States, Ukraine, Syria, Iran, ISIL, China, US, East, South, China seas. It's not overlapped. It's naturally to supplementary relations. So regime sharing, it's very latest problem. Distinctive democracy, China and Russia. Putin loves sovereignty democracy. China loves China own specific something. But we have institutional democracy. It's a completely difference. I can explain what the economic complementary or interdependence, military cooperation, military integrity, but I should keep this question later. I should wrap up 3 minutes presentation. Then finally, how should United States Japan respond to the new geopolitics? First, do not overestimate on the contradiction between China and Russia. So we have been thinking China and Russia are constrained by geopolitical limitation. But recent development, we are thinking whether we accept and manage realities of a kind of the associate alliance. I repeated, now Russia-China relations are approaching for the initial stage of kind of alliance, I'm afraid. So how we get it? So let Japan free from the geopolitical burdens. It means that now, thanks to Abe's administration's the security arrangement, Japan-US alliance developed. So if Japan managed these geopolitical burden with neighbors, namely the solving the territory issues, alliance could be more developed. Finally, it's a lot for the Washington audience. Most of you think Russia is an extension of Europe, but Pacific Russia is relatively calm and manageable, not so assertive in comparison with European Russia. So we think that the difference Russia in the Pacific, the European. I think that this is the time to think about that. Finally, we should also, cooperative moment, establish the maritime regime cooperation institution between the four states, probably including India or Southeast Asia. Finally, I wrap up the geopolitical map. So this map, so-called Hokkaido-centered map, by Hokkaido University. What do you think about it? It's Ohotsk Sea is bigger than Japan Sea. It's interesting. And if you are Chinese, what do you think about it? Oh, Japan blockade us. We should overcome Japan. But if you are Russian, if you are Japanese, what do you think about it? Okay, we together manage the maritime zone, Russia and Japan. So such kind of geopolitical thinking is very important now. And I've also affiliated the Kyushu University in the south. It's a Kyushu Fukuoka centered map. Then we have a different landscape on the south, east. China sees the different landscapes. But it's up to the Professor Maso's task. So thank you for patience.
Thank you very much, Richard, for both organizing this panel and for inviting me to participate. I particularly welcome our Japanese colleagues I loved that presentation. That was really terrific. For those of you who haven't done so, I highly recommend Tom Wright's op-ed yesterday in the Financial Times, in which he examines the geopolitical implications should Donald J. Trump become the President of the United States. It's really a must-read. So I very much view the Russia-China relationship through a geopolitical lens, but at the same time, I think it also reflects the increasing melding of geopolitics and the energy markets and the politics of international energy relationships. So I'm going to try, just like Professor Iwashita took the view of really a geographic examination, I'm going to sort of look at this relationship through linking energy with geopolitics. I'm going to go down from Tom's excellent 35,000 feet to sort of 15,000 feet. While the move to closer Russia-China relations really began with Xi Jinping's rise to power in China, I think the key driver has been the coincidence of the Russian annexation of Crimea and the imposition of Western sanctions following that, and shortly thereafter, the dramatic shift in energy market dynamics following the Saudi and OPEC decision in November of 2014 not to boost prices by limiting output. So I think that really, the coincidence of the Ukraine crisis and sanctions and the dramatic fall in energy prices in 2014 really is the concept, it is the main driving force here. Now, most observers at the time believed that Russia would be one of the biggest losers from this combination of Western sanctions and low energy prices. As an economy highly dependent on energy exports, in need of reasonably high prices to ensure profitability and sufficient foreign exchange earnings and budgetary resources, the Russian economy should be very vulnerable to this. There's little question that Russia, along with North America's unconventional energy sector, were seen by the Saudis and OPEC core countries in the Gulf as key competitors that they sought to cut down to size with the moves in late 2014. At the same time, the crisis over Ukraine was the first test case of the Western view of the new geopolitics of energy, the view that was based on the supposed leverage that could come from sanctions, including those on investment and tech transfer in the energy sector, which was part of the argument of keeping a military response to Russia in Ukraine off the table, that these non-military coercive means, financial coercive means, would be sufficient to achieve Western goals. So at the tactical level, Russia responded to these challenges in three ways, each of which has been reasonably successful. At the economic and financial level, in late 2014, early 2015, Russia allowed the ruble to sharply depreciate, which enabled Russia to husband its foreign exchange reserves and created fiscal space as dollar-denominated energy exports created more rubles for the Russian budget and provided incentives for import substituting local production. On energy, the currency depreciation helped Russian firms to double down on sustaining and increasing output. And in the aftermath of this tremendous drop in energy prices, Russian oil exports are actually greater today than they were at the end of 2014, allowing Russia to compete particularly with Saudi Arabia and sustain and even enhance its position in the Chinese market. And thirdly, of course, at the geopolitical level, Russia defied the U.S. and Europe on Ukraine with the extensive use of unconventional special forces that prevented the government in Kyiv from sustaining control in the southeast and reversed financial market sentiment that had initially assumed that the West's geopolitical commitment to Ukraine would triumph and facilitated financial flows to Kyiv. Today, Ukraine is a basket case. The Maidan revolutionaries' dream of Ukraine becoming a second Poland have receded, and Putin has dodged the bullet of being the leader who lost Ukraine to the West, while at the same time embarrassing Western leaders, especially President Obama, for whom bringing Ukraine into the Western orbit has become a geopolitical bridge too far. But beyond these tactical moves, at the core of Putin's strategy to respond to this dual challenge was to deepen Russian-Chinese geopolitical and energy ties, both in order to strengthen the Russian economy, to develop the Russian Far East, and to enable Russia to be positioned to capture energy markets in Asia. And Putin, in a series of addresses, made clear that he sought a strategic partnership with Russia, with China, rooted in and extending beyond energy. Now, burgeoning energy pacts coincided then with an apparent Sino-Russian strategic embrace across a whole spectrum of bilateral relations. Since 2013, senior leaders from both sides have met frequently, vowing always to boost their ties. Putin stated in 2014 that, quote, our position on the main global and regional issues are similar or even identical. China and Russia in 2014 alone signed roughly 100 high-level agreements. Both sides have cast themselves as jointly engaged in what the Chinese call the democratization of international relations, which in Chinese parlance refers to opposition to American unipolarity. They've sought to normalize the concept of cyber sovereignty, which is really national sovereignty over the cyberspace. In the military sphere, Russia and China have held joint exercises in the Mediterranean, in the Sea of Japan, and in the South China Sea in 2015. Russia has reportedly agreed to sell China S-400 surface-to-air missile systems, which would significantly boost China's counterintervention capabilities aimed at blunting U.S. power in the Western Pacific. They've sold China Sukhoi 35 multi-role fighters, which Beijing has had been seeking since 2006, enabling China to project power further into the South China Sea. So, taken separately, either the growing energy cooperation or the closer political ties don't necessarily portend larger geopolitical consequences, but the combination of the two have begun to partially reshape the relations between the two powers. By early last year, many Western analysts were expressing increasing anxiety about the challenge from a Russia-China alliance, either soft or hard. And such an alliance provides, in principle, benefits for both sides, particularly as each sees themselves in a competitive and at least partially conflictual relationship with the U.S. In the triangular relationship with Washington, supporting Russia helps China because it shifts U.S. strategic attention to the more flagrant behavior of Russia, and it tempts U.S. policymakers to offer side payments to induce China to help restrain Russian behavior. So I think all of this is real, and I think Tom's point about the challenge from the Russia-China relationship is real, but I do think it's important to look at this relationship in nuanced terms, and I think in a relationship that was substantially driven by energy issues continue to influence the direction of the relationship and actually in the last year or so have taken it into a less collaborative place. Even if the top-level leaderships in both countries are maintaining a rhetorical agreement on goals, cooperation in the energy sphere has already begun to founder. A year after the big gas deals, the Russia-China energy axis has lost a good deal of its momentum. Russia expected very large-scale Chinese investments into its natural resources sector to enable it to develop particularly its far eastern and northeastern regions. I think that Russia expected that China would be very supportive of efforts to further build out the pipeline infrastructure linking Russia and Asia. In the new market conditions of low energy prices and slowing Chinese growth, neither of these has the same kind of appeal that they did in late 2014. The Chinese haven't responded to Russian expectations to finance the new Altai pipeline, Power of Siberia 2. They have not made big investments as the Russians expected in the Vankor oil field. Generally, China continues to demand a lot from Russia, low prices and control of timetables from these deals. And the Russians, frankly, have been unwilling to continue to give in as they did in 2014 in the mega gas deals that were signed. Russia, I believe, is increasingly wary of becoming a resource appendage to China. And the long-standing fears of Russia about the rise of China are again coming to the fore. So presidential amity aside, I think that relations between the Russian companies and governmental ministries and the Chinese companies and governmental ministries are not very good. So I was in Beijing in December, met with a lot of Chinese officials and firms about this, and that was a pretty common view. Rather than a quick pivot to Asia and to China, I think Russia is coming to terms with its limited energy choices and the growth of very stiff competition, and with them continued dependence on European markets. I think what Russia saw in the shift to Asia, in the relationship to China, what was a strategic alternative to the mutual dependence, particularly in the gas sphere between Russia and Europe. The shift to China was not just about geopolitical relations with the United States. It was also heavily about Russia's relationship with Europe, and in this quest by both the Europeans and the Russians for leverage through options, through hedging bets. This was Russia's big hedge on its European interdependence. That hedge has not worked out very well, and I think what you're seeing now is a shift back by Russia towards Europe. Now, looking longer term, I think Beijing and Moscow will continue to have very ample arenas for both cooperation and for competition. I think the main area to watch in this will be Central Asia, which historically has been an area of Russian dominance. But in recent years, there's been an informal division of labor in which China had an increasing economic role while Russia maintained the dominant security relationships in the region. But right now, Central Asian states are actually competing with Russia for market share in the Chinese energy markets. And as China begins to implement the One Belt, One Road policy, the New Silk Road, which sees Central Asia as a transmission belt between the Far East and the Middle East and Europe, I think that Russian interests and Chinese interests are going to run up against each other quite substantially. So at the most abstract level here, Beijing occupies the driver's seat in the relationship. More and more, Russia finds itself in the role of a junior partner, as a taker, not a maker. The Chinese play this very well. I mean, the Chinese go out of their way to sort of hide this reality, right? And I think Xi Jinping has played his Russian diplomacy very good. I think they're very careful to not risk bruising Russia's sense of itself as a great power. But I think that in many ways their interests do diverge. I think perhaps the most important way their interests diverge in relationship to the international order is that, very different from Putin's Russia, China is effectively leveraging its increased global economic footprint to enhance its international stature, deepen relationships with other major global actors, and entice others to support China's aims in the global arena, be they the creation of the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank or the inclusion of the RMB in the IMF's SDR basket. So this is Chinese soft power, or soft power with Chinese characteristics, and there really isn't a Russian parallel to this. I mean, even Russia's attempt to win support in among the southern European states by portraying itself as a constructive actor in Syria has run up against the challenge that at the core of Russian influence is the use of military power and its inability to do that in a nuanced way in Syria, I think is quite striking. So I think that China's economic strength is enabling these achievements on the international sphere, despite Beijing's growing regional and cybersphere assertiveness. And I think that makes the relationship between China and the international order quite different from that between Russia and the international order. So my view here is that I think that the Chinese-Russian partnership is real. I think in particular the view on establishing regional strengths both in Russia's near abroad and in the Western Pacific for China is a very, very important shared interest that the two parties have. But at the same time, I think that the big driver of what brought Russia and China together over the past two and a half years was the enticement of the China-Russia energy partnership. And I think that market conditions are making those dynamics much less real. I think that energy dynamics over time are likely to make Russia structurally a much more challenging actor internationally, but the same isn't necessarily true of China. Thank you very much.
I'm sorry. Good morning, everyone. It is my great honor to talk in front of so many people today. I greatly appreciate the Brookings Institution and Dr. Richard Bush, who provided me such a wonderful opportunity to exchange with distinguished experts and scholars in Washington, D.C. I am Chisako Masuo from Kyushu University in Fukuoka, Japan. As Professor Iwashita has mentioned, I'm from the southern part of Japan, and I usually have a very quiet, you know, local life, in a very relaxing city. But as Professor Iwashita has mentioned, since I'm close to people say that Kyushu University situates in the Japanese gateway toward Asia because that was the traditional port between Fukuoka used to have a traditional port between Japan and Korea and toward China. I'm more focused on China's relationship with other Asian partners usually. But anyway, I've been working on Chinese foreign policy for many years and recently have visited many countries surrounding China to study how the neighboring countries, including Russia, is observing the rise of China. So I am delighted to be able to share with you some of my thoughts about this issue today. So today I want to argue that the return of geopolitics is real in this region, and the driving force is the rise of China. This is Dr. Graham Allison's words, a statement. The preeminent geostrategic challenge of this era is not a violent Islamic extremists or a resurgent Russia. It is the impact of China's ascendance, because this is something that can really challenge American dominance in the world. And I also want to argue that China is trying to reestablish its sphere of influence in the Eurasian continent. through our neighboring diplomacy and recent One Belt, One Road initiative and creation of AIIB and other forms of economic means. But I also want to argue that the emerging China-Russia axis is strong but not robust. China-Russia relationship is a marriage of convenience. For both sides, the relationship with the other is less important than the relations with the U.S. or Europe or to Japan. Both recognize the limitation in their relationship. But China-Russia relations symbolizes the new dynamism in this region. And the competition, I think our competition between the United States and China will last long. And the middle powers and sometimes small powers will have increased participation and roles in this power game. Especially Russia and India are going to take a big role in this game. So first, let me ask you where China is. I think all of you have the answer. This is China's map, is this border fixed? Is this a stable border historically? Let's look at some maps of Chinese dynasties, historical dynasties. This is Qin, Han, Sui, Tang, Northern Song, Yuan, Ming, Qing. I've only shown the maps of so-called the unified kingdoms of China. But as we have seen, even when China was said to be unified, the shape of its country varied very much. The coastal lines were relatively stable because, you know, with the older techniques, you could not expand beyond the coastal line. But the continental border changed dramatically over so many years. Here is current China. This red line shows where China has completed border demarcation with the other side. On the continent, it is only India who has not agreed upon the borderline with China yet. For the ocean, it is only the territorial sea in Tonkin Bay or Beibuan where China has agreed with Vietnam. China has not yet reached any other demarcation over the territorial sea, exclusive economic zone, or the continental shelf on the marine side under the UNCLOS. The relations between China's rise and border extension. Historically, Chinese borders fluctuated depending on its national power. When China was strong, Chinese territory also grew in size. Interestingly, this idea still seems to alive in contemporary China. In 1987, People's Revolution Army, PLA, raised the idea of strategic periphery, Zhangliue Bianjing. In contrary to the geographical border surrounding the territory and the territorial water internationally recognized, strategic periphery could expand and contract depending on the state's comprehensive regional power. That means when China grows, it can also expand its territory, or at least the sphere of influence, to the outside. Of course, there are restrictions given by the existing international order, Westphalian international order. In pre-modern period, China grew toward the west. Upon its rise, coastal lines were, as I have said, unable to extend. However, today, China can only extend its geographical border toward the sea because most of its land borders have been fixed already under the international regime. Toward the continental direction, however, China still sees the room for extension. And toward the continental direction, China can only expand its influence under the neighboring states' national framework. So it cannot make the real aggression, but it can only extend its spheres of influence through economic means, mostly. So if we summarize China's historical interaction with the other outside world, there is a clear contrast between its maritime and continental neighboring relations. As we have seen, this is China proper. Only this area was relatively stable to be included in Chinese dynasties. And, of course, the coastal lines were very stable. And on the coastal sides, until pre-modern period, there was no challengers against Chinese hegemony. There was China's definite dominance. Here, China could maintain relatively stable economic relations. Economy has been very important impact on this side ever since the closure of Silk Road. However, on the coastal side, continental side, China was often invaded by the enemies. And sometimes China also dispatched military there. On this side, China faced many challengers traditionally. Political hierarchy was reversible between Han Chinese and the other, depending on China's power. Traditionally, there was high security concerns, but less economic importance on this area. So let me go into China-Russia relations now. China's traditional relations with the other side is still China's traditional relations with the neighboring countries are still alive to some degree today. On the coastal side, economy still plays a significant role. However, interestingly, this side is also important in terms of security today. The U.S. is coming from this side. And especially after the Taiwan Strait crisis in 1996, China perceives the United States and Japan to be a possible threat to China. And upon China's ascendance, China can only grow to this side under the restriction of the existing international framework. And China is claiming all of the nearby water. So when China considers its external relationship, this side is the first priority, of course. On the other hand, China's continental relationship has less importance today for China. China feels much less importance of economic interaction with its continental neighbors. China feels no security threat on this side, but to hedge the U.S. and its allies, China can have convenient political alignment with Russia. And recently, China also works to extend its sphere of influence by winning over Central Asia, Mongolia, and et cetera. And the relationship on this side have been second-tier importance for China. It is only a dependent variable to the relations on the other side. But still, the relations on the continental side made a remarkable development over the last three decades, as Professor Iwashita has mentioned. Particularly for Chinese diplomacy, Shanghai Cooperation Organization grew out of friendship on this side grown out of friendship has a special advertisement value to this world for China. China thinks it is a symbol of its constructive involvement to the world peace today. And let me briefly look at this relationship from the Russian side. As you can see, for Russia, China has more importance. This relationship is quite asymmetrical. But of course, this is a map of former Soviet republics. And China is extending its sphere of influence to its former, Soviet Union part, like Central Asia or Mongolia used to be also a very close partner for the Soviet Union. And just like Ukraine, which used to belong to which used to be so close to Soviet Union, just like a Ukraine issue, it became Russia became so nervous about Ukraine, it can be very nervous about China's expansion of influence in the Central Asia. So it is true that China is the only reliable friend today. It feels a huge international isolation, and it feels very, very lonely, and it is only China who can extend hands to Russia. And economically, China is very important for Russia, but also Russia is increasingly getting sensitive to China's enlarged influence over those regions. And here also, I think SCO has provided a very interesting platform for interactions between China and Russia. In this SCO, China and Russia has interacted each other, and of course, Russia had very big influence over the Central Asian countries. But through this platform, China has tried to establish good neighboring relationship with those Central Asian countries. However, since China's extension of influence became so clear, Russia recently has gotten very nervous about this. And on the SCO platform, Russia has begun to approach India to hedge against China. India has been the observer for SCO since 2005, but recently it had applied for full membership in the SCO together with Pakistan. Actually, Russia was pushing India to apply for the full membership, and China didn't want it, so China also drew Pakistan in. And so last year, the two countries' participation was recognized, and by this year, their participation will be finalized soon. I have attended this SCO, one of the SCO meetings, and I did observe very tense kind of rivalry was going on between China and India. China was becoming more and more vocal about its leadership in the SCO, and Russia had to listen to China, and China demanded Russia to listen. However, of course, Russia was not happy, and it was trying very hard to draw India into this game. And when India participated, applied for the full membership, China did not say no, because SCO has been a very big advertisement tool for Chinese diplomacy. And of course, its enlargement means a kind of success for Chinese diplomacy, so it had to welcome it. But still, China wasn't happy about it at all. If you look at the China's continental and maritime relationship, neighboring relationship, geopolitically, it is very interesting. First of all, China is trying to advance toward maritime area down south, but then that made all the maritime neighbors very nervous. And of course, those countries want draw the United States back into the Asia Pacific, and they also try to interact each other more. But in the same time, interestingly, for example, Japan and Vietnam, it's very obvious those countries are trying to appeal to India. So India has become a very important, you know, game player in this Indo-Pacific region, and China's enlarged influence made Russia and, to some extent, Central Asian countries very nervous. And those SCO countries, other than China, are trying to bring India in. They're also trying to approach India. So both Chinese neighbors are trying to, are having increased expectation for India. We can see that the dynamism in Eurasian continent has been changing very rapidly because of China's ascendance. The rapid changes in the power configuration are awakening all the surrounding neighbors and all our participants in this game. Of course, the important players are middle powers and less extent the smaller powers. But still, you didn't see this game before. While all countries seek to maintain good economic relations with China, they also try to strengthen all the new ties with other friends to balance out a powerful China and possible risk China might bring to their countries. So far, Russia-China alignment is strong but not so robust. Each stand together for itself. They do not cooperate over wide strategic issues and or sensitive issues that might touch upon their sovereignty. And India is standing at a very favorable position in this new picture, just like China had been in late 1970s when it started the opening and reform. So this is a very big chance for India. Well, I do not have a slide for the last part of my talk, but I would like to mention briefly about my thoughts. Here, I'd like to ask my American friends some questions. Is Crimea, it sounds too provocative, but is Crimea that important for America? Is Russia a threat to the world peace? Who has more weight for the United States, Russia or China? In my eyes, China does have a potential to create a new world order that might go against the liberal democracy, which America has advocated for a long time, at least on the Eurasian continent. If the U.S. does not compete with China in a constructive way, it could be a Sinocentric order. It could change to a Sinocentric order in the Eurasian continent, where China makes decisions not based on the international rules, but based on the Chinese Communist Party's interest. It is preparing... China is already not hesitant to use its economic and military might to coerce its opponents, unfortunately. It is preparing to foray into Arctic, Antarctica, deep sea, and the space very quietly but evidently. On the other hand, Russia is an exhausted middle power that had been beaten up by the Western powers for a long time. It is China, but not Russia, the U.S. should put its foreign policy priority for the coming decade. To me, there is a possibility to approach Russia and avoid Moscow to form a stronger axis or ties with China to maintain a favorable balance of power for our side. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Thank you very much to each of the presenters. Each has looked at our question from a somewhat different perspective and come up with different answers, and you can see now why that question mark was so important. I have lots of questions myself to ask them, but I'm going to show restraint in the interest of having you ask the questions. So please... Once I recognize you, identify yourself and specify to whom you're posing your question, and please keep your questions brief so we can get a lot in. So I start with the person in the back on the row, and then I'll come up here and go back there.
Morning. Thank you so much for your insightful comments. My name is Alexander Sullivan. I'm with the Center for New American Security. My question is about Russia's few but nonetheless important friends, specifically in Asia. They do have longstanding ties with Vietnam and with Japan, which, you know, were at least up until Crimea showing some momentum. My question, and this is really for anyone who wishes to answer it, because I think you all have interesting perspectives on this question, but U.S. policy, it seems to me, has at times tended towards trying to constrain those, you know, Japan, Vietnam specifically, from improving relations with Russia, or even urging them to cease, you know, Vietnam to keep Russia out of Cam Ranh Bay and stuff. How do you think we should be approaching Russia's, you know, relations in Asia beyond China in the context of this potential entente?
Let's have one American and one Japanese answer. Dave, do you want to?
Yeah, so certainly U.S. policy has been to discourage both countries from cooperating with Russia. You know, I think in the case of Vietnam, I think, you know, the combined relevance of China on the one hand and the U.S. on the other really provides a pretty decisive limitation on what the Vietnamese are likely to do with Russia, and I think it's more likely over time for the U.S. to end up having access agreements to Cam Ranh rather than Russia. The Japanese side much more complicated, and I think here it really somewhat depends on what happens on both the Syria front and the Ukraine front. But I mean, right now, as long as U.S. relations with Russia remain conflictual on those two issues,
I think that U.S. policy should be to continue to discourage. But Japan is extremely interested in furthering its relationship with Russia, both the strategic and the commercial economic level. And I do think that if you can potentially get some kind of a breakthrough on Syria, which won't be easy, but I don't think is impossible, that could create the conditions where U.S. opposition to Japan more robust engagement with Russia would diminish.
Aki?
Yeah. When I was here in 7 years ago, I had two missions. One is Shanghai Cooperation Organization, how we understood. The second is how pitch Japan-Russian relations improvement to the U.S. foreign circles. But latter, I completely failed because I was invited so many times to make emphasis on Japan-Russian relations, very important in the Asia-Pacific context. But some Americans replied, what do you care of Russia? Russia first is nothing. I'm a bit shocked. I think that why I show the illustrate at the first beginning of my presentation, most of researchers here in the policy circles, people pay Russia only as extension of Europe. So they very, very involved in European thinkings, European matters. So then I concluded my presentation, separate Russian Pacific side from the European side. So the Putin has a different faces toward us. So our administration want to improve ties with Russia so much, but after the Crimean crisis, so the United States was pressed our government to go forward. So I think that you have more flexibility to us.
Okay. Gentleman right there on the aisle.
My question, my name is Muhammad Asmanul Karim. I am Bangladeshi American. My question is to Professor Mashu. Here is discussion China, Russia versus US Japan. And you told that China and Russia are good, historically good friend. But my question is, national and international relation depends on mainly three factors. One is race, another is region, another is religion. I do not find anything that Japan-China relation is worse than Japan, China-Russia, because race, religion, and region is there. Contiguous, but race and religion is different China and Russia. But Japan and China is more related in race and religion. So why you told that China, historically China and Russia is good friend? I don't understand.
You understand that?
Yeah. I think so.
You understand the question?
I think there is a very different understanding in the international relations. If you put focus in the Middle East, or if you put see the world from the European or Islamic point of view, religious is very important. That's the main driving force that decides the regional relations in that region. However, in East Asia, I think states play more important roles. So national interest plays bigger role. And China and Japan, between the Sino-Japanese relationship, religion never played important role. And probably it will be the same thing between China and Japan and Russia, too.
Okay. There's a question back in the back. Yes.
Good morning. Thank you very much. My name is Andy Steele. I'm at the Risk Assistance Network and Exchange. And full disclosure, I took Dr. Gordon's course at Georgetown.
Forgive me for that.
Thank you very much. I wanted to go a little bit further on the energy question and probe the shale gas revolution. I understand that China has invested billions into discovering their own innate capacity, second only to the United States. It's not a global market. LNG is expensive to travel. I don't think China is competitive at $40 a barrel of oil like the U.S. might be in some capacity, but just generally, if when it comes to domestic capacity and China's willingness to not always let price dictate what energy solution you go with, is this something that is affecting the Russia-Chinese relationship and any other considerations? Thank you.
Let me say a few words on that. I mean, I think that China, in a long-term sense, is intensely interested in domestic shale. With the collapse in prices and with the big increase in potential sources of energy, I think China's anxiety level around energy resources really come down in the last several years. And right now, I don't think there's a focus at all in the immediate term on shale because of that. I mean, China can get gas from all sorts of different sources. Oil prices have come way down. I mean, this is a huge... If you think about, given the economic downturn in China, what would have happened had oil prices not declined, they'd be in serious trouble now. But they're not, and I do think that over time this becomes important. I think this is one reason for China's intense interest in gaining access to the U.S. markets and to the Canadian market, North American market more particularly. So I believe that energy can be an important element of mutual benefit for China and the United States, and frankly, for leverage on the U.S. side. So it's one of, to my mind, it's one of the balancing elements in the relationship.
Never underestimate
in terms of shale. Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. I think that the shale uptake in China is going to be very difficult. But right now, it's driving a major interest on the part of China to access U.S. technologies and to participate in our economy. It's a big leverage point should we, both sides, become more interested in closing the bilateral investment treaty, which is something that I believe should be a priority for the United States.
Okay, I see a lot of hands. The woman on the aisle right here. Yeah. Yes, you. Wait for the mic.
Hello, everyone. I'm so glad I can be here to listen to the really great panelist speech. Just a very brief introduction. My name is Jishan Chen. I am a graduate student from University of Maryland College Park. I am from China, so I am really interested how all the panelists to see a rising China in for just questions like, what do you think about the neighborhood countries of China observed a rising China? Of course, I really agree that China are now really seeking a greater say in the regional issues. And also, I really agree with Professor Musso's opinions that these are the new geopolitics between Russia and Asia, Russia and China really exists. But aspect for the Russia and China assets is not that robust. I totally agree with your opinion. So my question is like, what do you think about the neighborhood countries of China would observe a rise in China in the regional issues? Thank you.
This is a huge question. We could have two or three programs on it. So what I'm going to do is ask you just to say, on a scale of one to five, and one is really bad and five is really good, what are the views of East Asian countries towards China? So we'll start with Aki.
Okay. Let me concentrate on the Indians' reaction to China. Okay, so I add something that to comment to Maso-san's explanation. I have a bit of different idea on the Indians' reaction to China. I have been contacted with so many Indian colleagues. So the Indians have changed the opinion toward China. So they say that why Japanese so afraid of China. So the Japanese sometimes think that the India worry about China, but India never think so. We collected 10 Indian scholars from Delhi, so various institutions. So they strongly debate among them how they think of the threat of China. So majority, as far as I think that, they do not care China's threat. They are more good ties with China. So please imagine what kind of mutual economic independence between China and India. Therefore, I have a bit different idea on the SCO image. Of course, Russia won't invite India to the SCO, but China not so objective. So it's a new geopolitical change, just at this point.
I think we'll go to another question. The gentleman right here in the hat.
Thank you very much for a wonderful presentation. I would ask anybody on the panel to discuss the Chinese relations with Mongolia. I have been to Mongolia twice on World Bank missions. My name is Elliot Hurwitz. I used to work for the State Department and World Bank and the intelligence community. Mongolia has traditionally been a U.S. ally. I was there twice, and I lectured Mongolian people in College Park, Maryland. How successful do you think China has been in its relations with Mongolia, the so-called 16th Republic of the USSR? Thank you.
Good. Anybody want to answer that question? Yeah, please, Giuseppe.
China's relationship with Mongolia. Yes. I think economically, China wants to enlarge its spheres of influence to Mongolia, but it is also true that Mongolia has been very cautious about accepting China's enlarged influence. So it always wants to play out China by extending its relationship with Japan or sometimes to Russia. And so it is trying to keep the Switzerland status in this great power game, I think.
Okay. Up here? Right there? No. Sorry.
My name is Michael Yehuda, and I'm attached to GW. My question is for David Wright. In terms of, if I understood his argument correctly, he was saying that America, in handling relationships with Russia and China, and I think presumably more with China, but that America should stress very much the rule of law and the general principle, if you like, that underlines the American vision of world order and the one that has been, I suppose you would have to argue, successfully operated, more or less successfully, for the last 70 years. Now, you also said that, and if I understood you correctly, that in not seeking a conflict or a military conflict with the United States. China has been pursuing a strategy of changing the status quo in its favor in incremental ways. So from that point of view, I suppose one would argue that Chinese are following international law as they understand it, or as they choose to understand it. And it doesn't necessarily correspond with the view here of international maritime law in particular. So if that were to continue, what do you think the United States should do?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think, you know, obviously in Beijing, they would say this is sort of a different interpretation of what international law, you know, is. But objectively, there are, you know, treaties, there are courts. I mean, there are cases, the Philippines case being, you know, one that's in front of a court, you know, at the moment. And I think that you could make the argument, and the U.S. does make the argument, and many countries in the region, that what China is doing is violating the law by trying to change the status quo. It doesn't need to rise to the threshold of the use of force. So I think what's important is to make the point that the U.S. has been making over in recent years, that these disputes, if there is to be a resolution, it has to be reached multilaterally, and it has to be in accordance with due process. I would just make one other sort of broader point as well, that, you know, somebody mentioned earlier about China's rise, and this is sort of coming to terms with the, you know, the rise and how it impacts the region. There's something to that, but I think, you know, we also need to remember that these are strategic choices that countries make. I mean, Russia's not a rising power, and it is choosing to challenge the order. China may not rise in the future, or it may rise, but the strategic choice it makes, it's somewhat independent of that. And it's less that they are rising and that's a challenge. It's more about what they're actually doing. And I think that's what we, you know, none of this is inevitable, right? It's something that people choose to do in their respective capitals. And I think they are making a choice in some of the South China Sea stuff that is more of a change than their ambitions more generally at the global level. The question, in case people didn't hear it, was that should the U.S. try to impose some sort of cost? I mean, that is a current approach. I would more say that it's what the U.S. needs to do is to think about what this means in the aggregate overall and how it's changing and how it's changing the region and how to advance a vision of order in the region that the countries in the region actually want. And so it's less about, you know, the president sometimes says if Russia or China does something, you have to impose a cost as if, like, you know, the then they will sort of reconsider later on. But we're missing the larger picture of what it is that key individuals or governments are trying to accomplish. And we need to be concerned about the net impact of that in a 5 or 10 year period and how and when to push back against that overall vision, and not to say, you know, they build an island in the South China Sea or put something on Wadi Island and therefore there ought to be a cost and then we move on, you know, to other things. We have to think about what this adds up to, I think.
Tom, let me ask you to respond to Chisako's last point. To put it simplistically, Russia is over and China is the future, so the United States should focus on China.
Yeah, well, it's not a view that that is rare in Japan. I think it slightly depends on where you sit, right? And certainly, if you sit in Eastern Europe, that is not something that they would feel. You know, Putin is likely to be in power till at least 2024. He has a very sort of different idea of international order and European order than America's allies do, and he has lots of capability to create mischief, even though in a century-long period, you might say that they are in decline. So I think, you know, I really don't like this whole rise-decline thing. I know we sort of get obsessed with it, but I think it really blinds us to what the sources of problems and conflict can often be. Many of the countries that have caused the greatest problems in recent history have been declining powers, not rising powers, partly because they worry that they're running out of time. They have to act before it's too late. And so I think that I don't think that Russia is is over by any means. And, you know, people, as my colleague Bob Kagan says, people have been predicting Russian decline for 400 years, and it hasn't, you know, somehow they're still around.
The gentleman right there.
Thank you very much. My name is Jane from Georgetown University. I have two short questions. The first one is for all the lecturers today. In light of the U.S. presidential campaign, what would the potential presidency of Hillary Clinton or probably Donald Trump mean for the future U.S. Foreign relations to these countries? And the second question is particularly for Dr. Iwashita and Masuo. In what sense that Abe's reinterpretation of the Article 9 would actually change the way that Japan interacts with neighboring countries? Thank you.
I think we have time for quick answers. You want to speak to?
Yeah, so I think that should Secretary Clinton become president, I think that she would probably, I think, move to engage personally more decisively with U.S. allies in the region, while also trying to sustain engagement with China. So she would, I think, follow a track not all dissimilar to the current thrust of U.S. policy, but much more hands-on, much more hands-on. I think that if Donald Trump becomes president, that what you would see would be a lot of sort of aggressive and assertive commercial, economic, and financial diplomacy vis-a-vis China. But actually, I think that Trump, unless overturned by others, his orientation would be to not be nearly as engaged as a security balancer in the Western Pacific.
Aki or Chisaka, do you want to answer the question about Article 9?
Short answer. So if you think of the recent security arrangement that the Diet passed, it's a 98% of Japan's color on Japan constitution said it was illegal. So it's a infringement against the constitution. But the Abe administration didn't care it passed. It means that Article 9 is sounds more symbolic for his kind of new Japan normalization. So I mean that it's not so realistically changed.
Gentleman back there.
Thanks. Mike Billington. I'm with the Executive Intelligence Review and the LaRouche PAC. One area that hasn't been discussed, a very close collaboration between China and Russia, is in the Middle East. The Putin military intervention in Syria, which was strongly backed by China and which was legal under international law, unlike the U.S. bombing, has, I think everybody now acknowledges, pretty much crushed Obama's regime change policy. And by cutting off the supply lines from Obama's friends in Turkey and in Saudi Arabia has created a situation where, in fact, ISIS could be crushed, at least in Syria and potentially beyond. In this context, Xi Jinping
can you
made...
Can get to your question?
Yeah. Well, it's about Xi Jinping's visit. Xi Jinping visited Saudi Arabia, Iran, and Egypt and offered to bring the Silk Road into the Middle East as the basis for peace, to bring it in now, to create jobs, to create cities, to begin the rebuilding. That, I think, is the key thing for Americans. How do we get Americans to stop this geopolitical confrontation with Russia and China, to join them in nation-building in the Middle East and around the world? That's, I think, what is the key issue facing all of us today.
Okay, Tom?
Yeah, I can take that. So I think I disagree, I think, with the premise of the question. I don't think Chinese views of the Middle East are similar to Russia's at all. I think China is actually very respectful of U.S. leadership in the Middle East, and it will be in America's interest for China to do more because its interests in its West are actually much more aligned with U.S. interests than its interests in East Asia. And I think that's a key distinction we have to make. And to go back to an earlier point for a second and just link it, you know, this is not about rising Chinese influence overall. There's many ways in which rising Chinese influence is a positive or something that's entirely legitimate. This is really, what we're really sort of arguing about or discussing is ways in which Chinese influence may be exercised, particularly in East Asia, that could be destabilizing over a 5 or 10 year period. And that's what's sort of worrying about it, right? So it's in the Middle East, in Central Asia, other parts, there will be times when we disagree, but actually it's maybe not, sometimes we make too big a deal out of it.
Yeah, the gentleman back there in the yellow tie, is it a yellow tie? Yeah, you. You turned with the beard. Yeah, right there.
It's a blue tie.
In the middle. Blue tie. Sorry. Are we talking about the same person?
I think so.
Oh, it's a blue tie. You're right.
Thank you so much for your thoughtful comments and insight into Asia Pacific and geopolitics overall. The question I had, in the view that things progress on the path they are progressing right now, if Russia and China do build an alliance, the quadrilateral security initiative that was proposed by Shinzo Abe in 2007-08, that there be a quadrilateral dialogue between India, Australia, Japan, and the United States, is it a viable option for the United States to kind of counter this growing alliance and secure some sort of geopolitical balance in the region? Or is it something that the U.S. should avoid? I mean, if such an initiative is taken, it would actually put the whole geopolitical battle out in the open rather than keeping it under the books for now. So is the quadrilateral security initiative a good point, and is it a viable option for the United States in the long run?
Please.
So I think the quadrilateral alliance goes forward. It's really independent of the status of the Russia-China relationship. It's a good point, and it's something that the problem for China in terms of their assertive posture is that it alienates others in the region, gives them much more reason to cooperate among themselves, and more importantly, it basically gives them all a powerful strategic interest in deepening U.S. ties across the board, but particularly in the security arena in the region. So that's the Chinese dilemma here, is that they can push and push and push and salami slice, but the more they do, the more they create this basis for an alternative. I think that the really interesting question in this triangle between Russia, China, and the U.S. is going to be the status of India, because they're a big geopolitical prize here in terms of what their ultimate orientation is.
Shako?
I would like to answer from the Japanese point of view. I think it is very important to pay attention to the difference between Abe's first and second administration. At the first administration, Abe tried to work out the Japanese-Chinese relationship by proposing a strategic win-win partnership between China and Japan. However, and he also tried to negotiate over the East China Sea issues, and he did work very hard to negotiate with China. But all of the Japanese efforts to negotiate over the East China Sea issues failed because China, in many cases, in all of the cases, didn't comply with the agreements between Japan. So in his second administration, he has given up to negotiate with China anymore. And he had applied a tit-for-tat strategy. China was playing the game with the power, and Japan wanted to apply power. And for Japan that has very strict restrict under the Constitution, the forming alliance or partnership with other countries was a rational choice. Thank you.
Okay, we've come to the end of our time, so I'm afraid I'm going to have to sort of close this down. But and obviously we could go on for a long time, but our panelists have kept going for 2 hours, and I think they need to take a rest. I want to thank each of them, particularly Aki and Chisako, for coming all the way from Japan. Thank you for your attendance and for your great questions.